Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. We have a guest who is actually joining us from Bozeman, Montana, Seth Carlstrom of Height. In just a moment, Seth will be with us and tell us all about what he is up to. And remember that you can find us on Facebook or you can email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. Just a moment. Seth will be with us. Thank you so much for listening. This is Heartstock. Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Our guest this evening is Seth Carlstrom. Hi, Seth.
Hi. How are you?
We're doing great. And how are you in Bozeman?
I'm feeling warm now after that cold snap. Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for asking. Yeah, it's been a little stressful around here, but it's all part of the job. So
yes, and you are in startup mode with Height.
Yes, correct. Yes, that's true.
Can you give our listeners a little intro here as to what Height is and what you do there?
Yeah, that's a little complicated to give a elevator pitch, but I'll give it a go. Basically, I conceptualize improved designs of products made of technical fabric and then take those to production. And that's both domestic and international production. So I'm a product designer. Height is a product design studio. And I focus on proving the designs by prototyping. So I build a lot of things. I sew a lot, which is a fun story by itself, kind of.
Yes, and I'm very intrigued to hear it because I was looking at some of your educational background and training. Mm-hmm. Where did you get your start in the business of product development and sewn goods?
So I got my start by getting jobs in the industry. I guess the first time that I ever understood what a product designer was, well, I guess way back when, it was sort of like, I have this idea, I want to be like an architect, but for not buildings, I want to design other things. And what's that called? And I was reading a Motor Trend magazine or a Road and Track or something else, and there was an ad for something called industrial design in the back of it. And I went and found out what that was, and then I thought, that's what I want to do. And then those schools are very expensive, but I'm a native Montana and I'm from Billings, and so I got a good scholarship to MSU. And I studied mechanical engineering, and I ended up with a degree in mechanical engineering. And then I mentioned the jobs, but I worked at a company called Salient Technologies, and they gave me a great start learning about how to conceptualize and draw things. I've always been quite artistic, I suppose, but it was how to apply it and how to make a meaningful piece of art that communicates an idea, and then how to take that through to figuring out all the little details and the measurements and the material specifications and things, and hand that over to people. But I actually got my start due to a great guy, a good friend called Richard Sibrel, that he worked at Patagonia for a long time. And I had been making my own jackets because I'm 6'7" and very lanky. And I was tired of having cold wrists when I was outside. So I started to make my own clothes, and he saw a talent in me and invested a lot of time, and he still invests a lot of time. And he brought me into the fold about what industrial production sewing can be and what the design aspects of that takes. Everything that you buy, that you've ever bought, you know, somebody had to figure out what machine that it would take and what the seam allowances would be and how it fit and what material it would be and how the grain of the material went. And that's kind of the details that I follow. So I owe a lot to a lot of people that aren't me, but my engineering background really helps a lot, especially when it gets to the nitty gritty of production. And then I do have some, I guess, study formally at NC State in textiles themselves. But that's just a little bit. NC State, North Carolina. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, there's a whole cluster of textile sewn goods type cooperatives there that I have stumbled upon myself. So do you think that Bozeman has this kind of cluster as well, it seems? Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My dad keeps asking me, why do you live in Bozeman? Because I'm always complaining about, well, excuse me, but Bozeman's changing a lot lately, right? and he asked me, why do I stay in Bozeman? And it is absolutely because this is maybe the only place in the state where I'm just a little ways away from the Sims Fishing Wader Factory. I'm like a half mile away. And so the buckle reps and the materials reps and, you know, these salespeople, the people that I work with directly to get that material to prototype with, they come into town in Bozeman. And it's probably, I think it's the only, as far as I've talked to people, it's the only town that people, they have a client list here that they come and visit. When Mystery Ranch has a factory and Sims has a factory and West Paw has a factory. And there's many people that do what I do here, which maybe people don't know. It's a wonderful little hub. It's very cool. I appreciate it greatly. Anyways, it's really saved me from, mechanical engineers are pretty much fated to have to move out of the state because what I do is mostly mechanical engineering is with the second tier of trade or economic. Oh man, now I'm forgetting my economics words. Excuse me. But it has to do with manufacturing and the processing of raw goods. And there's just not a ton of it in Montana. But I got fortunate to get in with the right industry. And Bozeman happens to be this wonderful little pocket of people that all do kind of the same thing, especially in the outdoor industry, which is where I do a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. And you said that you got a scholarship. You received a scholarship to MSU. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. The MUS, the Montana University System Scholarship.
Gotcha. And how did you do that?
You know what? I can't remember at this point. So many people got it. I remember there was a large assembly. I went to West High in Billings. And there was a large assembly, and I think like 35 different kids at West High got it in our graduating class. And I think that it was based on academics. I think the idea is to keep Montanans in Montana. And well, you heard it here first. Like it works. It worked for me. So yeah, I think that's exactly what it's for.
Gotcha. And then you stayed in Bozeman because of the job.
I did. Yes. I count myself very lucky that Salient, the company that I was working for, they saw a talent in me as well. And they actually hired me partway through school. And I worked part-time as a designer while finishing my degree. So for the last 2 or 3 years of college, I worked there and then continued to work there after I graduated.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that there were influences in your life early on, high school
to what way?
Yeah, high school and before that, you can look back and say, "Aha, this was something that was bubbling up in me, even as a youngster and in my youth."
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I've thought about this quite a bit. I'm so happy that you asked. So shout out to Melanie Richard. I was good friends with a young man named Daniel. And we've been friends for years. I think that we went to church, our families went to church together. And so we were connected at the hip basically, but his mother has a fine arts degree and she works at Zoo Montana and some other places doing sort of diorama design and whatnot. But anyways, longer story shorter, that was like the fun thing that we did. She would teach us how to use SculpiClay and how to paint and how to draw and how to sew and how to XYZ. And then her two boys, if they didn't like a toy, They would like cut it apart and paint it and put it back together the way they wanted it. And I remember when I was little, I thought that that was very strange. And now I, as I'm older and I reflect back, I think to myself like, oh my gosh, that's why, you know, it was like this no boundaries sort of like things don't have to be that way. If you don't like it the way that it is, then maybe there's a better way to do it. And, that was a huge influence on me. And then like, as far as my actual business goes, I think that my father basically, I mean, he said everybody could talk about their dad for a long time. And I guess that's not what this podcast is about, but he basically taught me that the buck stops with you. If not you, then who? Right. Mm-hmm. And as far as design goes, that's really what design is. I was speaking with a friend of mine the other day about the difference between art and design. And she suggested that she had heard this thing. It said that designers answer questions, artists ask questions. And I thought that that was really eloquent. It's not complete. It's not the whole picture, but it's like it's a really good description. Sort of as a designer, especially, you know, I mentioned going to production and being responsible for tens of thousands of something being produced at the most, at the least, you know, 500, but still 500 of whatever's being made. You have to decide everything about it and why it's there. And if it's not you deciding it on behalf of yourself or for your client, in the case of my work, a client, then somebody else is making that decision and it's not you. And it's going to be not in your interest. It will be in their interest in the case of factories or import, export or whatever. So there's a lot of influences over time, but the creative aspect, I'd say my best friend growing up, his mother, and then we didn't have a ton of money, and that also made us really resourceful, I think, as people. And so there was a lot of repurposing things and being frustrated with lackluster product. You know, I grew up hunting in Army surplus, for example, and then I'm around now the Sitkas and the Kuyus that sell the camouflage that costs $500 for a jacket. And it's staggering. It's so different. It's so interesting. What I think that there's just a sort of a dichotomy there, or a contrast that made creativity more powerful. It wasn't just expression. It was useful. It was a tool. It was a means to an end. And I could blather on, but I'm sure there are more questions.
Yeah, and I'm really wondering about your decision to go out on your own. I mean, you had what sounds to me like a pretty cool job at Salient. Mm-hmm. And what was the impetus to start Height?
Sure. I think that there comes a time for everyone that you understand that you're not receiving the full benefit of your knowledge. You're not feeling the value that you're providing to other people. And I came to that moment and decided that because I was so familiar with my function and that I was familiar with my industry, that I could take that on as my own. And I think that that's probably the story for a lot of entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
But that's me.
How long has it been since you founded your enterprise, and has it been what you thought it would be?
Yeah, good question. So it started only this summer. I was formerly, my title when I left this past company was Director of Soft Product. And so I was in charge. I do now what I did there. I actually purchased myself out of my non-compete, and I purchased the physical assets of that company and the electronic assets, the client list, the goodwill. So it was a mutually beneficial parting, I suppose you could say, or it was amicable. Mm-hmm. There, that's the word I'm looking for. Amiable, maybe. So as far as the startup mode, it's been interesting, as you know, because you're an entrepreneur as well. When you leave somewhere where the bills are being paid for you, the insurance is all figured out, it's a completely different animal to rent a space, to find the space to rent the space, to make sure you have internet, to make sure that you have insurance, because that's part of a commercial lease. You learn about all of the administrative aspects to do with the business and QuickBooks, how to run QuickBooks, for example. And so in many ways, it's been exactly what I thought it was going to be. My job hasn't changed, but there's more. There's more now. I find it really satisfying to figure out some of these things and to to define the way that the business operates, and then, you know, to speak with the lawyers and understand what a contract should say and why it should say it. And I find it very satisfying and very, even though it's hard, and I must admit, it took me about 5 weeks of working around the clock, just 16, 18 hour days, but I burned out after 5 weeks of that. And realized what recovery means and why you have to recover.
Yes.
And it's something that I've never had to deal with. I'm very energetic naturally, I think, but to be just sort of depleted, to be at the end of your rope and there's nothing left to give. I had nothing. I reached the bottom of the tank. And to recover from that while operating the business and speaking to clients and being on time and X, Y, Z is incredibly difficult. And I think that for me, it made me grow up. I'm a young man still, but it made me mature. And people call me mature for my age already. But my gosh, the lessons that I'm learning right now, just because it's out of the frying pan into the fire, it's the crucible, it's go time, it's sink or swim. So you have to make those decisions and mature quickly. Otherwise, you're done, you know. But yeah, I think it's been awesome. I like it.
Good.
Yeah.
We're a little bit past that halfway point. We're going to take a quick break. And in just a moment, we will be back with Seth. And he'll tell us a little bit more about his endeavors. This is Heartstock. And I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Thanks for listening. Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Our guest this evening is Seth Carlstrom of Height. Hi again, Seth.
Hi.
So manufacturing, it seems like there's an aspect of it that is just always going to be pretty much the same. But then there's also some pretty interesting technological advances that are impacting manufacturing. What do you think about all of that aspect of your enterprise?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, the technological aspect of manufacturing. So first and foremost is automation with computers and servos and, you know, XYZ solenoids and whatever have you. And the cost of machines is going down. You can buy a robot arm for nothing compared, I mean, relatively speaking these days, and you can program it easily. They're making very easy to program robots. Automation is absolutely somewhere where the world is going. The pitfall maybe of automation, besides, you know, the obvious question of if we give all the jobs to the robots, then who's working, right? But I think that people think that automation is sort of a panacea. It's the thing that's going to save us all and do amazing things and whatnot. And for hard industries, hard goods, things made of metal and plastics, automation is the way. I mean, plastic injection molding, the reason that we can buy some of this plastic stuff so cheap is those machines can run almost by themselves, which is amazing. One of the things that I really love about what I do in fabric is that fabric, for everybody that doesn't know, comes on big rolls and it has a grain and it has cross grain and has bias stretch. And for every fabric, that's different. And it's not like calling out like aluminum. Oh my gosh, I'm going to ruin this. And some engineer somewhere is going to be like, ah, what an idiot. But it's like, you know, like not, it's not 10, 20, whatever, you know, it's not just, oh, this is the way it is. This is this spec. And everybody knows exactly what alloy that is. the fabrics are all different. And from the length of their fibers to how furry, for lack of a better word, the yarns are, how much the yarns are twisted, how tightly woven it is, how big the yarns themselves are in diameter, if it's coated, if it's not coated, there's endless variables. And to take the time to characterize all of that and then program a computer to react to it is incredibly costly, especially most of the businesses are doing design through contract factories these days. And they're working on that product for 2 weeks of the year, and maybe four if they have two orders, or six if they have three. But the line that is operating on that is only has that. Now, you could argue that they can do that once and then move on, but in these textile goods, the styles are changing usually, and there's new textiles coming in all the time. So I digress. One of the things that I love about what I do is that it's extremely hard to automate. You can automate in a few certain ways, but it's very difficult. But other than that, I mean, the obvious way for me that technology has improved is the ways that you can communicate with overseas factories is startling. To just email, and you can take a video of yourself explaining what you think about. I just did this the other night. I took a sample that I was sent and ripped it open on a camera and explained how it had failed. And because the camera can autofocus, I can put it in front of the camera and it could look at it and focus right exactly where I wanted it to, so that they could see what I was looking at. And the communication aspect is the most positive aspect 100% of technology. It's been a game changer to have to go. I mean, obviously the best thing to do is to go to the, the best thing that you could do is go to the factory. And I have a billion stories about how wonderful just being in the factory can be for the productivity of a project, the little things that you notice and how to get something to production. But a really great tool is email and WhatsApp and FaceTime, and it's staggering. I can't imagine how people did business before. It must have taken ages to do anything. We can move so quickly now with increased accuracy. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine part of that slice of pie is the number of errors and mistakes, costly mistakes, that can be avoided because communication is so much easier and direct and faster.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the ability to track, to have a paper trail, email. A keyword search in email has saved my buns more than I care to mention. Just looking for some little clue about what somebody had said one time. That's the unsung hero, is your email keyword search.
And how about made in the USA? You mentioned, getting things from factories in other countries or abroad. Mm-hmm. And here we are really, and I wonder sometimes, reinventing the wheel, so to speak, because it wasn't all that long ago that the United States did make a lot of things. But mm-hmm. not so much anymore. What do you think about all that?
Oh my gosh, we could talk for hours about this. And I'm looking at the clock with fear because I want to say so much. So I won't beat around the bush any longer, but Made in America is so important, and it's absolutely become in my industry. So it depends on the industry, but in sewn product, we'll just talk sewn since that's what I know best. But it's become a very intense process to try and get something manufactured in the United States. Labor is hard to pay for, and it's getting older and people are retiring and we aren't finding replacements for them. When the East opened up, when China opened up to Western trade, it was an obvious choice that the cost of a manufactured good is determined by the labor and by the materials. And in sewing, it's very labor intensive. And so it was a no-brainer. We were inevitably going to go East. And that was just a numbers decision. Since it's a free market, people were getting cheaper goods and you couldn't compete unless you had your really high quality. And I hate to say it, but the truth is that Made in USA, we are lacking some of the skills that the rest of the world has picked up and taken to the next level. What Taiwanese people know about laminating fabrics to plastics is mind-boggling. I mean, I'm just thinking about different areas and what they know best, but there's new technologies emerging, like bonding, which is gluing textiles together and welding textiles together, that is. And America is so slow on the uptake because these factories normally get set up and then keep doing what they were doing because it's scary. The margins are low. And we're in a tough spot. Until we bring those skills back, Made in America is a huge prospect to ask Made in America to be competitive with goods made overseas. And it's not just for the cost of labor. It's actually now the know-how and the experience and the expertise. I can't tell you how, you know, part of the reason why, for all my clients listening, I mean, I insist on going on these factories visits. And I already mentioned how valuable it is for the project, but completely personally, I learn more walking around a factory, listening to people talk in broken English at me and just showing me things than I could any other way. The Western world, we fell behind. I thought that you summed it up very well. The race is going and we were walking for a bit. We have been walking. We're still walking. There is a lot of technology. And then the other aspect is suppliers in the United States, manufacturers of the raw goods. They are very protective of their intellectual property and not very willing to share or change that. And that's a whole nother topic.
Maybe we will be able to revisit this again because it's a deep subject, deep and broad. How mm-hmm. might our listeners find you, Seth?
So I've got a website, www.height.studio. And there's no .com on that. That keeps happening. But it's just height.studio. Or my email is seth@height.studio.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for doing what you're doing and for being our guest here on Heartstock.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, thank you for having me.
And we will see you next week. Once again, this is Heartstock. I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Peace.
The sign it said, no trespass.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org.
That sign was made.